Hello, my name is Celia Joseph. I'm from Squamish and Nanaimo Nations on my dad's side, and I am British and Jewish on my mom's. You are listening to CITR Radio 101.9 FM. Welcome to Unceded Airwaves. This is UBC's first ever Indigenous radio show, and it is being created weekly by the Indigenous Radio Collective, which is a combination of Indigenous and non-Indigenous people here on campus and beyond who are interested in radio and Indigenous issues. I want to start by acknowledging and thanking the Musqueam people for hosting us as we are on their unceded traditional and ancestral territories. This is the third episode, and today we have Anishinaabe PhD candidate Lindsay LaChance, who's also a friend of mine, coming onto the show. And she's going to be interviewing Anishinaabe activist, artist, scholar Leanne Simpson.
Ani, hello. My name is Lindsay LaChance. I'm Anishinaabe Kwe. I am a third-year PhD student here at the University of British Columbia in Theater Studies and First Nations and Indigenous Studies program. I have been an uninvited guest here at UBC on the traditional, ancestral, and occupied territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people for 3 years, and I'm very lucky and honored to be able to explore and develop my work here, and I'm very thankful to have been invited onto the episode today, so miigwech to Celia and the collective for having me. And I'm very excited to be able to share with you the conversations that we've had with Leanne Simpson. She is a very inspiring person, both within artistic realms and also within the She is a very inspiring person within the artistic fields and also within academia. So it's been a honor and a privilege to be able to have worked from her resources to help really understand and organize how to navigate myself within the university institution. And so we're very thankful to have her work and the work of other amazing Indigenous scholars to help us go through our works here at the university. And it's so exciting to see Leanne's artistic work develop, and we're really excited to be able to talk to her about process, about creation, about performance today, and to share with you some of the works she's been working on. And yeah, we hope that you enjoy, and thanks for tuning in.
She wrapped a woman up in a blanket from the bay and rolled her down a hill to remind everyone that blankets are for swaddling and not for smallpox. I went down the very same hill with wet mittens and soggy boots, on a plastic toboggan, a foodland bag, a cardboard box, and my raincoat. The teacher is telling me I should feel proud because toboggan is an Indian word. I'm telling the teacher that out of everything, this is a strange thing to feel proud about, but she disagrees. I think your cultural heritage is a mighty fine thing to feel proud about, Leanne, and I think it will lead to great success in your studies. The Duke and Duchess are coming to visit, and all she had to wear were ripped jeans and black t-shirts. So she made a dress with saucers for nipples and a beaver lodge for a bustle. If you would just read more post-colonial theory, you'd understand that your anger is part of the binary of colonialism and therefore colonial. And if you just take some of the things from the settlers and some of the things from your ancestors, you'll find you can weave them into a really nice tapestry, which will make the colonizers feel ambivalent, and then you've altered the power structure. I liked the saucers for nipples idea so much that I start wearing dinner plates around the house over t-shirts. I liked the idea of wearing dinner plates over t-shirts so much that I start wearing dinner plates over t-shirts and under plaid shirts. Mom starts shouting into the phone. She's wearing those dinner plates again. Starting off low and slow, accelerating into a crescendo of plates again. After the dress, she made a fountain, but not the kind you throw money into and wish to fall in love or win the lottery. The kind that says, hey, Anishinaabe Kwewak are stuck in this endless goddamn loop and nobody gives a shit. Your work is polemic. If you could rewrite the tone of this article to avoid shaming Canadians into a paralysis of guilt and inaction, we could move forward with the publication of your article. It's Montreal, and I think it's spring because I remember garbage on the sidewalk. You start the sentence with the reclining figure in white people art, and everyone stops listening. He's mad because he dropped his bagel on the ground and no other kids have to go to fucking art galleries. She thinks the woman in the light box looks cold and starts talking about growing up and making hamster houses out of old computers for her job. I'm wondering, when I cut my back like that, can you sew me up the same way with the fringe and the beads? Kichidakwe's sign said, I am worth more than $1 million to my people.
Ani Kinawaya, my name is Leanne Fitesmasek Simpson. I'm a writer and an academic and an activist. I'm from Alderville First Nation, and I am of Machis Agik Anishinaabek ancestry.
Thank you so much for that introduction and for talking with us this afternoon. We're really excited, and it was nice to see you last Thursday at Emily Carr. Maybe you could speak a bit about what you are doing in Vancouver and the talk at Emily Carr.
I was in Vancouver on Thursday, and I actually spoke at Capilano University in the morning and then SFU in the afternoon, and then I had an evening lecture at Emily Carr. And I spoke mostly at Emily Carr about my artistic process as a writer, where my work comes from, how I try to base a lot of my aesthetics and storytelling techniques in Anishinaabek processes. And I talked a lot about how my process is really community embedded and how it's a very, I guess, rich artistic experience for me to collaborate with Indigenous musicians and filmmakers and artists of different disciplines to sort of add layers to my poetry and my short stories.
Amazing. That all sounds very exciting. And these ideas of process and collaboration is something that hopefully we can talk more about today. So I guess to start, I know that in Dancing on Our Turtle's Back, you are very clear about not wanting to provide a definite example of resurgence. And I know people ask you all the time, oh, can you explain what resurgence means? And so I will similarly start this conversation in just saying that for our listeners and for everyone involved in the collective, maybe we can get on the same page by talking through maybe some examples of where you've seen resurgence or how you've worked through concepts of cultural resurgence in your artistic practice.
Well, I guess for me, whether I'm talking about my academic work or my artistic work, I think the land is sort of the spine of both of those practices because it's the spine of my life. And I think probably about 2 decades ago when I was in my early 20s, I made a decision that I wanted to learn how to think with inside Anishinaabek thought. And I wanted to learn how to think in a way that maybe my ancestors did. And so I became very interested in that way of thinking about the world, but not just thinking about the world, that way of being in the world. And so I did a number of things from ceremony to, you know, artistic practices to being out on the land to having a lot of ongoing conversations with different elders and different sort of Anishinaabe intellectuals, I would say. So people who are really trained and dedicated to living Anishinaabe intelligence, to sort of try to be able to learn how to do that. And that's something that was not going on and really isn't going on in universities and post-secondary education. But I think it's sort of really critical that as Indigenous nations, we're creating, we're creating that next generation of elders or land users or people that can sort of live in the world in a different way. I think that's the best way to put it. So when I sort of dove into a lot of Anishinaabe philosophy and theories and processes and ways of being in the world, it was a very, very rich experience. And I sort of started out talking about resurgence theory and what it means to sort of look to our ancestors and learn how to think and learn how to be and sort of revitalize our political processes, revitalize our intellectual processes, really put those Anishinaabe, when we call it, those Anishinaabe practices at the center of our life. And that was sort of my window into it. And then sort of once I got more, I guess once I sort of deepened my understanding of that, I sort of came to realize that I think within my nation, Anishinaabe people have always thought in terms of creating and in terms of resurgence. And so I think there's a line in Dancing on a Turtle's Back that gets quoted by students a lot, I guess, who are forced to read my book and study it in their classes, that resurgence is our original instructions. And so this idea that you have to sort of find out who you are according to your own traditions and your own practices and your own desires and your own gifts, and for us, your name and your clan, and sort of go on this journey through life where you're self-actualizing and you're trying to figure out how to be yourself. So it's a process of finding your voice and a process of aligning yourself, I think, with those original instructions and those creation stories. And that's, of course, a very difficult thing to do when our nations are so strangulated, to use Audra Simpson's word, by settler colonialism. But I think that's what I mean by resurgence. I mean creating that next generation who is fundamentally, distinctly, uniquely Indigenous, who can think that way, who can live that way, who can figure out how to set up systems of governance and politics based on those practices, despite everything that's going on. I think that's what it means to me.
Absolutely. So, in regards to this idea of an Anishinaabe aesthetic, do you ever think about who this would include or excludes, this idea of reception in regards to the work that's being done, or how other people would be able to enter or not access this idea of the Anishinaabe aesthetic?
I think I've been really clear in my work that I'm writing for an Anishinaabe audience first, as sort of a political intervention and as an intervention of love also, I think, not just political. I feel like that I, as an Anishinaabe person, there isn't a lot of books that I read that I think, oh, I think that I was the audience for. I don't see myself and my experiences and the experiences of my friends and family often reflected back to me. And that's certainly changing. It's certainly changing quickly in the last 5 or 10 years. But certainly when I was growing up, I didn't have that experience when I was reading books. And so it's really important to me that I'm writing for an Anishinaabe audience first, an Indigenous audience, then broader. And then if other people want to come in and read, then I think that's wonderful and beautiful. But I think there's a lot of pressure right now on Indigenous artists to write for the white mainstream, because that's what publishers are looking for in order to sell books. And that's not something that's particularly interesting to me. Now, it is pretty interesting to me to think, to write work that's layered and coded. So somebody who's maybe coming into Anishinaabe culture, so who maybe didn't grow up that way, because I have that experience as well, would still be able to sort of identify and come into the work. And that's that idea of layering work so that there's different levels of meaning, and so that someone can read the book and have maybe no understanding of Anishinaabe processes at all, and still enjoy it and still find some humor and still, you know, experience narrative and story. And then somebody who has a lot of experience with Anishinaabe philosophies and Anishinaabe ways would be able to engage with the work in a deeper way. And that's really actually how I think that our the so-called traditional teachings work. When you're in ceremony or when you're in lodges and elders and those kinds of ceremonial leaders are speaking, they speak in a way that kids and people who are maybe new to that sort of environment can get information and can get comfort and can see themselves. But then they also, the stories are also layered enough so that if you've heard the story for, you know, your whole life, if this is the 50th or 60th time you've heard it, that there's still meaning that can be revealed. And so that's really interesting. And I talked a little bit to Lee Miracle about that because I noticed that in her writing as well. So I like the idea of, I know at university we talk about theory a lot and we talk about aesthetics a lot in art and writing in terms of that, those underlying things that give our work meaning. And I really like the idea of using Anishinaabe aesthetics and theory in order to provide that deeper level of meaning, because I think the work then unfolds in an interesting way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can speak to that as well, having been grown up in an urban mixed Anishinaabe family in Ottawa, Ontario. So I, you know, read your work and doing a PhD, my methodology section is like, Caitlin, it's pedagogy, dancing on a turtle's back, true. Like, hitting up everything that I can grab from your work in order to create some sort of paradigm that will be accepted by both protocol, theater studies, you know, this idea of creating a PhD prospectus, but that still acknowledges other ways that I've been taught or that I work as well, especially in regards to art and this idea of aesthetics. So I think that hopefully you're stoked to know that across various disciplines, people are finding great comfort in your work as something that we can hold on to as young Indigenous people who are trying to also find ways to incorporate this into both academic work and also this urban space of the institution in which we are forced to abide by. So
that does provide, that is very good to hear, because when I was a PhD student at the University of Manitoba, I was in my 20s, like it was 1997 to 1999, and I desperately wanted to use an Anishinaabe methodology in my PhD, and people were barely sort of talking about it. It was just sort of recently realized that Indigenous people might have their own ways of knowing. That was something that was very novel in the academy at that time, and we were like light years away from sort of acknowledging that Indigenous people might have their own theories. Like, whoa, that was crazy. No one thought of that yet. So methodology, I feel like at that time I was like, oh, I understand how this is working from watching elders. I understand the ways that they're using to come to know. And so I didn't have sort of the framework around that. I didn't know the creation stories well enough to know where that was coming from. But I could see that methodology. So I went to my committee and they said, I only had white professors for all of my degrees. And so I think they had no idea what I was talking about or what I was doing, but they were super supportive. And they said, you have to get this published in a peer-reviewed journal before you can use it in your PhD. So I had to go get my methodology published before I was allowed to use it in my PhD. So, and then I had like a huge fight with ethics, and it was an ordeal back everything was an ordeal back in the 90s. So it's really awesome to see that this is useful, that journey, that the pain of Leanne in the academy is useful to you guys. And I'm really excited to see what this generation does with it too, because I think this kind of generation of Indigenous students right now is the most privileged generation that we've ever seen. You've got Indigenous profs, you've got a body of literature, you've got supportive people in the academy, and there's still tons of like racism and sexism and heteropatriarchy, and it's still no picnic. But I think there's tools that didn't exist when I was there, so I'm really excited to see your first books and your dissertations.
Oh, thank you. That's really nice to say. And we do feel very lucky, and always try to acknowledge the people who have put the work in for us and who help guide our work. So it's very important for us to share that with you, especially because your works are taught within First Nations and Indigenous Studies program a lot. I know you've been able to come out and guest lecture and speak and work with us a bit, and you know, we're just always thinking about ways to bring you back out. So now we have your artistic practice that will find a performance space for it.
Perfect for this world. The immediacy of mosquitoes, humidity choking breath. My beautiful singing bird. 5-year-old Kichidakwe crying silent, petrified tears in the back seat until the dam finally bursts. You are the breath over the ice on the lake. You are the one the grandmothers sing to through the rapids. You are the saved seeds of allies. You are the space between embraces. She's always going to remember this. You are rebellion, resistance, reimagination. Her body will remember. You are dug up roads. 27-day standoffs, the foil of industry prospectors. She can't speak about it for a year, which is 1/6 of her life. For every one of your questions, there's a story hidden in the skin of the forest. Use them as flint, fodder, love songs, medicine. You are from a place of unflinching power. The holder of our stories, the one who speaks up. The chance for spoken up words drowned in ambush. You are not a vessel for white settler shame, even if I am the housing that failed you.
My daughter and an elder and some of our friends were out picking wild leeks in our territory in May. This was maybe 5 years ago. And on our way back, we ran into a very racist worker who yelled at the elder and my daughter, who was about 5 at the time. And it was her first experience with racism and sort of the evils of the world. And she was very, very upset. So over sort of the process of the next few months, I was trying to get her to talk about what happened so that she could kind of process it. And I was really worried that she was kind of carrying the shame of that man around. And I wanted to help her, but she was unable to talk about it because she was so upset. And so I was speaking about it with my friend Tara Williamson, who is a Anishinaabe Cree singer-songwriter. And she suggested that I sort of deal with my own stuff around it, and suggested that maybe I write something. So I wrote a poem and I sent it to her, and she wrote music around it and sent it back. and then we performed it a little bit around Peterborough and Toronto. And then Kara Mumford, who is a Métis filmmaker, approached us and asked if she could make a film for the song. And she asked if my daughter Minwe would dance in it. And Minwe was interested in dancing in it. And so a group of women, Rulan Tangen from Santa Fe and Kara and Tara and I, went back to the place with Minwe where it had happened. We picked leeks. She danced and we filmed it, and sort of this process of making the film over the summer of the next year with this group of women, in a very, very gentle way, allowed Minwe to sort of open up and remember the mean man, and for us to be able to say that she didn't do anything wrong and that it wasn't her fault and that it was sort of on him. So it was this process that was led by these Indigenous women artists of sort of healing my daughter in this really, really beautiful way. So, and what came out of it was a poem and then a song and then some dancing and then the film, which is on my website if people want to look at it. But yeah, that's the track, Leeks.
It's so beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. Celia and I actually were in Dori Nason's feminisms class in 2013 when you came in and you spoke about Leeks and showed us a video, and we were all crying. So beautiful. Yeah. And so, yeah, and a few weeks ago, I taught a class for Dave Gertner when he was gone and also played that video. So it's just, yeah, great to be able to have the amazing work that you have created that we're able to share in classrooms and that we're able to revisit and talk about and really hold up and honor the work that you're doing for all of us. So, again, just great. But we're very happy to have had you talk with us today. And so that's something else that is really interesting to me is I'd love to learn more about your artistic process and your creation process, and especially if we could talk a bit about your transition from publishing in this world, I guess, more so of academic work to now your performative work, because it's lyrically beautiful, but from a performance perspective, I'm also really interested in spaces wherein Indigenous bodies are performing art, music, theater, and dance. And so I'd love to talk a bit about your creation process from the written text of Islands of Decolonial Love into the performative aspects of the works.
Yeah, so I feel like Islands of Decolonial Love really was born out of dancing on a turtle's back when I was sort of writing the chapter about art and about making and about how Anishinaabe society is a society of makers and how important it is to have a practice. And I sort of wondered if I had a practice because I think academics, like, we like to write about things and we like to think about things, but sometimes we don't do things. And I know in my life, doing things is really, really, really important. So I sort of, I also sort of felt really constricted by academic writing, because you can sort of only you have to back things up and you have to have footnotes and you have to justify when you've got a new idea. So I needed a space that was freer than that. I needed a space where, hey, I want to explore gender and I want to explore different kinds of genders. And I want to write a story about that. And I want to really normalize that. And I don't want it to be an academic paper where I'm, you know, researching and having endnotes and stuff. So that's sort of where Islands of Decolonial Love comes from an artistic process. Then sort of in my own life as a mother, when my kids were born, I wanted them to grow up in a nest of stories. And I wanted them to know the stories of their nation and the stories of their family. And so I started telling them the stories that I knew. I started telling them my family stories, which are mostly party stories. And then I sort of moved into traditional stories and learned more stories from elders, and they kept pushing me because they had such a, they were sponges for this kind of storytelling. And eventually kind of the women in my community noticed that I was doing this, and I started to get invited to places as a storyteller. And then my friend Patty Shaughnessy and a group of women around her run, for a number of years, ran an Odum and Gizas Festival of Indigenous Arts and Performance in Peterborough. And Wanda Nanabush was curating a very large exhibit of site-specific pieces in performance art. And she had sort of all of the major Indigenous performance artists in Peterborough. And as part of that, she also had a teepee with traditional storytellers, and I was one of those storytellers. And this was sort of my first performance of storytelling that was not sort of, you know, with kids that are pretty easy to please, but also pretty willing to tell you when you're boring and your story sucks. So I was so nervous because the audience was like really fancy art people from Toronto and like Rebecca Belmore. And I was sort of like just coming out of being a stay-at-home mom for a number of years. And I was like, I don't like what's going to happen here. I remember like, I was so nervous outside that teepee. I thought I was going to puke. So it was time for me to perform. And there had been kind of a snag in the schedule. And the electronica band Oka was playing on the main stage. And you couldn't hear the elder that went before me over this electronica band. So for me, they brought in a mic. And I started telling the stories that I had prepared over the mic or over the music. And Oka played this one track called Sun Pad, and it was kind of mellow. And I started to sort of just speak over it, and it worked really, really well. And actually the audience thought it was planned. So then maybe a year later, a tribe called Red came to do an All in the Family residency at our Nojem Theater. And they had five generations of Bear Witness's family there. And I did another collaboration with them, sort of a similar that track actually ended up on Islands of Decolonial Love. So that's this sort of where the practice began. And it was sort of not something that I set out to do. It was something that I was kind of doing. And the Indigenous women artists in my community sort of noticed something and kind of suggested that I see where it took me. And so I ended up applying for grants and collaborating with a bunch of Indigenous musicians for the Islands of Decolonial Love album. And then that was initially just to be a recording. And so it was difficult to figure out in some ways how to transform that into live performance, because we got invited to do a lot of performances after that. And through that, through the last couple of years of performing it, I've learned a lot about performance, and I've learned a lot about writing to music. And so this past summer, I was in studio in Toronto recording a new album, and it was recorded both as a recording but also as a live show with a core of musicians. And I'm really excited about that album and about touring it, hopefully in the spring and the summer and over the next year, because I feel like I've learned some stuff and I've figured out some stuff, and I know how to do it a little better this time. And I like the space. I like creating sort of environments. I like creating little islands of decolonial love or decolonial space where Indigenous people can sort of just relax and feel good. And I really like interacting with audiences, and that's a really interesting energy. And it's something that you don't get as a writer, because you're not there when people read your work. And so a lot of times writing is really solitary and isolated, because it's just you in your head. And then you're not there when people engage with it. But this is quite different, and it feels powerful. It's powerful for me personally, because I feel like I had to face sort of a lot of insecurity and doubt. And it takes a lot of bravery for me actually to step up to the mic and speak my truth and not feel like a fraud. So I feel like it's good for me to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And definitely there is a big vulnerability in performing and putting yourself in front of people to share things. It's my most hated part of theater. I moved into theory for a reason, guys.
Well, yeah, and I feel like, yes, you're very hidden in the academy, right? Because you've got all the this armor. And so for me to go backwards, it's an extraordinary level of vulnerability, but at the same time, like, just sort of dropping. For me, I don't know, it's taken me a long time to be able to get up to a mic and speak my truth as an Indigenous woman in an unapologetic way. I think your generation, you guys are younger than me. I think that you guys do it better than me and it's easier for you, but I feel like it's, or I don't know, I'm just making an old lady assumption, actually. Maybe it's not easy for any of us, but it's taken me a long time to be able to be just like, this is my experience, and like, fuck you if you don't get it.
True.
Yeah.
It's a very specific feeling, and for me it's like when I speak at home or when I show my work at home, I actually really like coming to Vancouver because I'm not nervous. Everyone's very positive. Everyone's super supportive. Lots of people show up. But here I'm always afraid, really, really nervous. I'm scared. I think I'm not good enough. I think I'm a fraud. I think I'm not Anishinaabe enough. I think all of those stereotypes and all of that negative kind of violence that you've grown up in sort of really comes up for me right before I step on stage. And then after, when everybody is loving and supportive, it's like the biggest high. It's mm-hmm. so much love and so much amazing. It's such an amazing feeling. So you're right. That's mm-hmm. a very interesting process. And it happens to me every single time. Mm-hmm.
You spoke a bit about this on Thursday at Emily Carr, but I'm really interested in hearing more about your frustrations with always being categorized into these sorts of genre-based categories of now she is doing spoken word and now she is doing poetry and now we're watching a music video. And so I'm just wondering if you could speak a bit about how, you know, manifestations of contemporary Indigenous art actually can't be easily differentiated into these pre-existing genres and labels because of the layers that you have spoken about and that you find present in your process and also in your performances.
I feel like the experience of my whole life is me not fitting in, and and the academy I didn't fit in. And I was told in the academy that I wasn't a good writer, that I started in science and I was a really bad technical writer, and that's actually very true. But I was too emotional. I was talking, you know, you can't talk about this, you can't talk about that, you can't have, like, can't be poetic in the middle of an academic paper. And so I was just constantly told that I was wrong, which is probably what propelled me outside of the academy. And I think Landa's pedagogy is sort of my victory, in that I think that's the way that I write academically. And for 20 years, people told me that I couldn't do that. And then I just did it one day and the world sort of opened up and supported me and supported that. And I think that's also true artistically. Like, I think that I think that what I am is a storyteller, and sometimes that story is told academically and sometimes it's told through nonfiction and sometimes it's told through fiction and sometimes it's poetry. And all of that are very colonial to me, categories of stories that make no sense within Anishinaabe practices. So I feel like because I live in my own little bubble and I try to put Anishinaabe practices at the center of my life, I don't really care what people, how they want to categorize me. I more care that the work gets out there. It makes it more difficult for funding because I don't have a full-time job. And so I rely on arts funding a lot to make this work. And I fall through the cracks. And so people think my work is not spoken word, but it's not music, it's not performance poetry. And so it doesn't really fit into any of the funding categories except through Aboriginal arts in Ontario. So there's difficulty there. But beyond that, it doesn't really matter. And I think that I've been able to work with publishers and people that can sort of vision outside of genre. And also, like, I don't have any sort of formal artistic training in a Western sense. And so the genres to me are like baffling, and I don't really get them. And I think I said it, Emily Carr, I don't really give a fuck. Am I allowed to say that on the radio? I don't really care. I feel like the world needs to sort of open up a little bit, and indigenous people think differently, and our art is different, and the categories don't make sense, and who cares? Like, it's feelings, and it's messages, and it's politics, and I think that's what matters, that connection and the heart of the work.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so inspiring and amazing to hear you say that. That's just why I wanted to ask you, so that you could say it again, because it's so important. And I think that, as you say, with having a lot of Indigenous students in university right now trying to find ways to articulate the practices that we do or the practices of our peers, it's like, well, you know, I don't think she's making theater, and I don't think she's making performance art. I think she's making Gwich'in art. And so it's really cool to be able to find these sorts of spaces that, as you talk about in Lana's pedagogy, we're not changing to fit in anywhere else. We're making based on our bodies and our ways of knowing and being and being in relationship with each other. So yeah.
And I think that's a real expression of Indigenous sovereignty and self-determination. And I think the older I get, I just sort of expect people are going to accept that and expect that that's normal, and go in there and sort of go in confident, like, I'm sovereign because I am. And I think that's been a really powerful shift in me, to not ask permission and to not go in sort of like, oh, I wonder if they're going to think what they're going to think of this, but to just go in with my head held high and do it. And I think for me, the process of getting to be able to do that is really, really exciting. And I think with this new album, I really wanted the lines between songs and poems to be really, really blurred. So I wanted people to listen to come out of listening to the album and think like, that was really awesome, and I don't know what that was. And a few people have said that so far, even though it's still sort of in the finishing stages. So, yeah.
We're excited to hear it.
It's soon. It's just, it's about to be mastered. And then early in the new year, we'll sort of figure out a release around it.
That's exciting. So I guess in general, we have been talking about this for most of the conversation, but I'm just wondering if you would be able to share a little bit about how you feel Indigenous art has decolonizing impacts within our communities, but also within spaces like universities or art galleries where curators are non-Indigenous and putting on shows, and what happens when music or performance or visual arts is put out for the public.
That's a difficult question, and it's something that I think about a lot. And I think in terms of my own practice, again, I'm when I'm performing for Indigenous people, and I want Indigenous people to come out the other end of my show in a better spot than they came into it. And I want my work, my creative work, to sort of be able to fuel the struggle, right? Because I think it's a struggle right now to be Indigenous and to be an Indigenous woman or a two-spirit queer person right now. It's a struggle. I think it's a struggle for all Indigenous people. And I think we have like this huge road ahead of us in terms of resurgence and decolonization and in terms of land and our bodies. And so I think I want to help fuel that by making people happy for a little bit and feel good for a little bit and see themselves reflected in a positive way and maybe be validated. And so I don't know that my creative work, I don't know that any of my work changes anything. I think it's it's very difficult to change settler colonialism as a structure. And I think the way to do that is by directly and strategically in a collective, organized way, building struggle around that. And I'm not sure that my art does that, other than on a very personal level for me. I think that my practice is an act of decolonizing, and the way that I make art is a personal decolonizing and Anishinaabewan practice. I think I start to get very uncomfortable around the gaze of the white audience and sort of trying to figure out how work gets read and appreciated or not appreciated by that audience, because I think the history of showing our art and the history of performance and the history of our writing has very much been under that gaze, and there's been this performative aspect to it where white Canadian society is really happy to have us dance or to have us perform or to go to a play even, but are very reluctant to talk about missing emergent Indigenous women and girls and Two-Spirits, or very, very reluctant to talk about dispossession or returning land or gender violence, so any of these sort of big issues. So I feel like I haven't figured that aspect out, other than when we make art on our own terms, and we're working for a very specific purpose, and we're uncompromised about that, then I think if the rest of the world sort of takes an interest, then that feels better to me than sort of trying to make art as a way of very deliberately, or trying to make art for that audience. I think trying to intervene and trying to change things is always a really important act, whether it's done artistically or academically. But I feel very personally uncomfortable with that in my own work. And I know not all Indigenous artists do, but that's something that I don't really have to worry about that, because I'm not, there isn't very many non-Indigenous people that are interested in my work. So it's not like I really have to worry about that, but I do think about that. It's a good question.
Yeah, I think about Audra Simpson talking about acts of refusal and trying to apply that to art and to creation and to process. And I think it's really interesting to think about it in that way as well, what artists are choosing to share and what they are not.
Yeah, and I think I'm very interested in having my work recognized. I'm interested in recognition within the Anishinaabeg Nation and within Indigenous nations. And I'm very uninterested in the politics of recognition within Canada in terms of my artistic work. And so that's something that comes from Glenn Coulthard's work, and that I'm very, very deliberate and very aware of when I'm creating. And I do also really like the politics of refusal and figuring out what that means in terms of artistic practice, because I think we have very strong traditions of that, and I've only recently heard Audra kind of articulated in that way, and so I think that's something that's also very interesting to me.
Art as politics.
Art as politics.
I love it. Yeah. We are really excited to hear and see more of your work, and we are big supporters. And yeah, it's very important for me to speak for myself, but also for all of the other students that I have spoken to, or friends and colleagues that I know who are really always inspired and motivated by your work. So you really have helped us continue on in our works, our research, and our areas of study. And I know that a lot of my hopefully future work will have been predicated on what you've gifted us. So, chimiigwech for that.
Well, thank you for saying that. And thank you for doing the show and having me on it. I love community radio and I love campus radio. And I will make sure that you guys are first on the list when the album gets released.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming on. And it was such an honor to get to sit and hear you and Lindsay chat with each other. And I echo what she said. I think we're all grateful. You definitely have a little posse of women over here who think you're a total superstar. So,
thank you so much.
If I write in small characters, no one will notice my grandma's lying on a picnic table in Dufferin Grove Park. Anakobijigun ancestor, Anakobijigun great-grandchild, Anakobijigun great-grandmother. The sign in the park says, when an Indian dies on a picnic table in downtown Toronto, call 911. Do not touch me. Do not call 911. And get that fucking look off your face. People keep stopping and asking if we want help. Like dads with jobs and espresso and buggies and couples with indoor scarves, sick in love. It's because no one is calling 911. They're trying to be nice because the scene doesn't make sense. She says to me, I got really smart by reading every book in the Rockton Library. Or maybe you don't think I am so smart, little Miss PhD. I tell myself that this is a good place to die, even though there are hot dogs and cake and balloons. It's outside. There are no fluorescent lights. There's no one trying to fix the damage that can't be fixed. She doesn't want death to be like a math test, I tell myself. She says to me, all husbands are boring, so pick one that lets you do whatever you want. I notice her fetal skeleton underneath iron polyester dress pants. The loving family is locked in a telephone booth of rising anxiety. We are stretching our necks to take the last sips of air. She says to me, if you don't have 7-Up, you can mix vodka with beer. The kids are digging large holes in the sand and then placing driftwood across the holes to make bridges. I don't know where they got the driftwood. It's downtown Toronto. But I'm glad they're not paying attention. She says to me, you work too hard. You'll never be happy. Anakobijigun, to tie together a bond, a link. Anakobijigun, my broken paper chain from when I was 6. Anakobijigun, to measure loss.
I want to thank Lindsay LaChance and Leanne Simpson for being on the show and for letting us learn from your teachings and your stories, and thank you for sharing your art with us. I wanted to say that the first spoken word piece we heard was called Smallpox Anyone, and then the last piece that we just listened to was Ishpadina. And thank you so much for listening again this week to Unceded Airwaves. We always will be playing Mondays from 11 to 12, and we have our episodes podcasted each week online at catr.ca, and just search Unceded Airwaves and you'll find us there. My hands are up to you. Up next is Synchronicity. Stay tuned and have a wonderful Monday.